Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Kirsten Diprose.
There are serious questions being raised about football ovals with cricket pitches after the devastating incident of 27-year-old footballer and high school teacher Nathan Fitzgerald, who is now receiving end-of-life care. Nathan played community sport for the Epping Football Club and on the weekend was playing against Laylaw at the Laylaw Reserve. The Epping Football Netball Club president, Luke De Vicintis, spoke to Justin Smith on ABC Radio Melbourne Breakfast this morning.
Head knocks in football are prominent, but the outcome that it stems from this particular head knock, I don't think anyone has ever dealt with before. So, yeah, it's difficult.
Luke, do we have a better understanding of what happened?
So we know that in the process of laying a tackle, that there was a couple of knocks to Nathan's head in that process. So there was a clash of heads at the beginning of the tackle, and then on the way down there was another knock to his head, which could have been by a flailing boot or a knee. And then he's hit his head on the ground and has been reported on the part of the ground that's much harder than everywhere else, where the cricket pitch runs through the middle of the ground. And the cricket pitch was covered, as all the cricket pitches are on all the multi-use football and cricket ovals throughout the country. But it is still substantially harder than the other parts of the oval.
And so we have this, right, Luke? So three head knocks. And when you say cricket pitch, we're talking about an artificial pitch. So concrete underneath and the artificial turf on the top. Is that a concern? I mean, are there been concerns raised about that scenario?
Oh, there's always been some risks and concerns involved around the cricket pitches on footy ovals. I guess, unfortunately, because we're just local amateur sports, we have to be able to use these facilities for multiple purposes. But the risk does come that there is quite a hard strip of surface in the middle of a ground where there's a high-velocity, high-contact sport played on. I do hope that there is this is explored, and potentially the way that cricket pitches are covered moving forward is something that can absolutely be looked at, because it is a significant risk, and I think the weekend has proved what a dire outcome can be from that.
That was Luke De Vicintis, president of the Epping Football Netball Club, who spoke of Nathan Fitzgerald as a much-loved teammate and has called for the hard surface cricket pitches on football grounds to be investigated. We'll dive further into this emerging issue. Good morning. Kirsten Diprose here with you on The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria. I'm filling in for Mary Geeran. Also coming up, mysterious space junk has washed up on North Queensland beaches. So where did it come from? We'll try to find out as much as we can with astronomer Fred Watson. And famous wedding celebrant Adam Sandler was Taylor Swift's wedding celebrant, and you told us on the text line that Australian actor Jane Clifton is also one. She'll be joining us later, and then we'll be off to the ballet. Yes, the Australian Ballet is opening its doors to the public here in Melbourne.
This is The Conversation Hour with Kirsten Diprose.
Well, Nathan Fitzgerald's football club has called for an investigation into cricket pitches on sports ovals as the 27-year-old Epping footballer receives end-of-life care. It's an incredibly tragic story that I think has shocked the entire footy community sport community. So hard cricket pitches are covered by synthetic grass or sand during the off-season. So the question is, should we be playing on multi-use ovals? Rochelle Imey is with us right now. She is a professor of sports science at Federation University. Hi, Rochelle.
Good morning, Kirsten.
This is obviously just an absolute tragedy that's happened to this club and indeed to Nathan's family.
Oh, it's absolutely devastating.
It has called into question the use of these multi-purpose ovals. Has there been concerns about these sorts of ovals before this?
Well, the AFL and cricket have synthetic turf standards and guidelines related to both performance and safety standards. So they've done a lot of research independently done over the years to analyse and then have guidelines based on either the shock pad matting, which is synthetic pitch cover, or they have soil, sand and grass. But, you know, I live in regionally and, you know, every footy oval that I've seen is a cricket oval as well. So, you know, they have to be multi-use, but we need to make sure that they're safe.
Well, how common is this that we have the multi-purpose ovals?
Well, regionally, I've seen every oval is both cricket and AFL.
Right. And with the artificial pitches, you sort of describe what they're made up of, but could you, really go into what's underneath? Is it concrete at the bottom?
Yeah, it's a concrete base and then synthetic over the top. But then what they do for the football season is they either lay another shock pad matting, like another synthetic grass with a lot of sort of rubber padding underneath on top of the original surface, or they cover it with sand and soil and natural grass.
So is it harder than grass still? And then it can be slippery as well, I understand, if it's wet.
Yeah, obviously it has a different texture to it when you're playing rather than the natural surface, and I'm not sure how it changes when it's actually wet. I'm not an expert in natural turf as it is, but obviously it does change the dynamics, and it's in the middle of the ground, so that's where they're, you know, playing where the ruck is. So it gets, and it's quite a large area as well, so it's, you know, over 25 metres synthetic turf pitch is by nearly 3 metres, so it does take up quite an area as well.
Rachel Imey is with us, Professor of Sports Science at Federation University. Look, we heard the Epping Club president describe what happened, and it was sort of 3 knocks to the head in total, so a couple on the way down. You know, it's hard to put a whole picture together. It isn't just that one fall on that part of the ground. Something else happened. How will this be investigated, do you think?
Look, I think obviously this surface will be tested and reviewed. But like you said, it sounds as if they had a head knock before. He had a head knock or two before his head hit the surface. So that surface may not have played into account at all. I mean, there's always a risk of injury, unfortunately. And with head injuries in AFL, there's been a lot of research being done, you know, helmets or no helmets. But we need to always try and have, you know, look at safety of the players first.
Does this raise anything from you and your research? Is it something that you feel like should be investigated more, or have you formed an opinion on whether we still should have multi-use football grounds?
Look, I don't think logistically it'd be possible to not have multi-use football grounds. There's just not the space in cities to build duplicate ovals, or there's not the money to do it. I think if the AFL and cricket have done the correct procedures in their research to look at safety standards, and if they're upheld by the councils that have those ovals, well then, you know, that's the best that they can do.
Rachel Imey, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Rachel Imey is with us, Professor of Sports Science, Federation Uni. The number to call is 1300 222 774, and our text line is 0437 774 774. A few of your text messages: the head injury problems are caused by the totally reckless tackling allowed in Australian rules, always has been. Yes, hard surfaces are not good, but tackling is the issue. But there is a culture of denial about it. Peter Kennedy is with us, ABC sports reporter. Hi, Paul.
Hey, Kirsten.
Apologies, I called you Peter. Paul Kennedy.
Been done before. That's okay. PK is okay for me.
That's right. Look, that last text message, what do you think of that? You know, we've certainly had a lot of coverage of late about the dangers of CTE and the lack of movement from the AFL on that.
Yeah.
Is this actually a high tackle or just a tackling issue?
Well, I don't think so. I think that the two, this accident involving Nathan seems to be different to the concussion, ongoing, necessary discussions around concussion and how best to treat and protect footballers. This one seems to be, as you've rightly pointed out, a discussion around what we do with the pitches. And I think that's, you know, conflating the two at this point before we know more about that particular incident, before it's investigated, I think's probably, not worthwhile. Both deserve our attention, and the health and safety of people in sport is where it should be. But I think it's a really interesting discussion around the surfaces. These pitches, as Rochelle said, run right through the middle of the ground. It's where you start the game. The centre circle, I'm looking at the oval where this accident took place. The centre circle is right next to the pitch. In fact, on all of these suburban ovals, the centre circle is moved, so it's not on the pitch, which tells you something in itself. You don't want to come crashing down on those pitches.
Yeah. I mean, from what Rochelle said, it has been an issue prior to this, and even the Epping football president said it had been a concern. Is this the first case like this that we've seen, though, where the consequences have been so tragic?
Yeah. Yeah, it's the first time I've ever heard about an accident like this. Over my time in football, which, you know, goes back 45 years probably, it's the coverings of pitches have changed. And in the last 20 years, I've never seen it better. There used to be just a standard, and we're talking about suburban grounds that are not turf wickets. So that's a distinction that the people who don't understand this might want to make. If you play cricket on a turf wicket, the conditions in winter are completely different to the ones we're talking about, where it's a synthetic pitch and you just need to cover that one pitch. It used to be that they dumped a whole lot of dirt on most of them. So I used to run around on grounds, and in the middle of the ground was this 6 inches of dirt covering the pitch. It was quite a soft landing there, but it had its other problems too. If the dirt got shifted, then you've got a very hard surface exposed underneath. Recently, with the advancements in the technology, the pitches have been quite good. They, as Rochelle explained, they lay down a rubber covering with a synthetic grass, which is quite springy, much better than it used to be, but still a place where you don't want to come crashing down. And my feeling is, players understand that better than anyone, and there's some caution around those hard surfaces in the middle, where it's sort of almost an unspoken rule where you really don't bring someone to the ground with any sort of aggression on the pitch. You know, it's almost like and a training too. You always hear a coach yelling out, "Stay off the pitch," just to be extra careful. But the coverings have got better, and I'm looking at an aerial picture now of the ground where it happened. It's a sort of bright green. It looks like a pretty standard covering that you see in virtually all of the suburban grounds these days.
Paul Kennedy is with us from ABC Sport. What about the grounds? Who are they looked after by, maintained by?
They're maintained by councils. So they basically leave the pitches covered during the footy season. It's a set and forget type thing. There are still suburban grounds, many suburban grounds, which do have the same situation as the country. Most country towns will have the turf wickets, and some metropolitan grounds have turf wickets. Now, these are the ones that I think are even more dangerous because they're governed by the council and they don't have the resources to have individual curators on a lot of them. That can vary. The conditions vary wildly during winter. If there's no rain for a couple of weeks, those turf pitches, and we're talking about big squares, not just one pitch, they can get quite hard and almost like an ice skating rink to run on. And then you see players tiptoeing across them. So to me, those are the most dangerous things, very hard. And then, of course, if it rains, those are the grounds that turn to mud in the middle, like we used to see in the old VFL days at Moorabbin and these other grounds. Princess Park used to be mud in the middle. They're the old turf wickets that turn to mud in winter. But if there's no rain, they really harden up. But that's not the situation we're talking about here. This one is...
This one is a council-run facility by the looks of it, and the council takes care of the grass. By the way, the grass is way better these days than it used to be. They're all, you know, most grounds have been relayed in the last 10 or 20 years, so the grass is pretty good. But the pitches, are, as I say, usually just roll out that safety covering, set and forget. But I do think the president that we heard from earlier has a great point. If this accident has been made worse by a covering that could be better, then definitely it should be looked at 100%. I'm not here to say that there's nothing wrong here. It has got better, the coverings, but I think it would be a good time to look into the safety of pitches around, you know, those metropolitan grounds.
And I would imagine there will be some form of investigation down the track. And even in this particular case, from what the club president described, there was 3 head knocks in total. So,
he's describing a head clash, and really, there are a few worse ways to get injured on a field. I mean, a head clash is sickening. We've all been at the football where you watch players, and unfortunately, they clash heads. It is a sickening clash. It does happen. Rarely, but it does happen. And, you know, the other part of that tackle is that if his head's ricocheted and been hit by something else, it's even worse. And you could not imagine a worse thing happening on a football field.
Mm. This is obviously an incredible shock and tragedy for a community. The club president spoke about thinking of the family, Nathan's parents, particularly at this time. How does a community, you know, get through this when it is such an awful thing that has happened?
Yeah, just by being together, that's the number one thing. I'm sure that the sporting community will provide support for Nathan's family. They'll never, ever forget it, and it'll be as part of the club's history for a long time, perhaps forever. It is an awful thing to go through. I went through it, as many people do. If you spend a long time in football or cricket clubs or netball clubs or sporting clubs, you know, something will happen to one of your members that you'll have to come together and get through it, basically. You don't know how you're going to get through it, but you will. And, the main thing is to support Nathan's family and friends, and make sure that they're not isolated and that they can be together in the hardest times.
Paul Kennedy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Kirsten.
Paul Kennedy there from ABC Sport, as we try and sort of make sense of the senseless with what's happened on the weekend with 27-year-old Nathan Fitzgerald, who is now receiving end-of-life care after that head clash and then the fall onto the grounds, which is also a synthetic cricket pitch as well.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Kirsten Diprose.
Well, strange ball-shaped junk, space junk, has forced the closure of beaches in northern Queensland. So where is it coming from? There's speculation they could be leftover parts from rocket launches, but there's also concern they may contain hazardous chemicals. Well, leading Australian astronomer, Professor Fred Watson, is with us. Hi, Fred.
Hello, Kirsten.
Thank you for joining us. Can you explain what's going on?
Well, I'd love to be up there, actually, having a look at these things. I mean, space balls on the beach is a headline that you really can't resist, can you? So the likelihood is that these are parts of one of the, perhaps at the upper stage of a launch vehicle, a rocket, which re-entered the atmosphere and basically broke up and left these fuel, they're basically fuel tanks, they're spherical fuel tanks, strewn across the beach. And the reason why I say that, rather than it being junk that's actually come from orbiting debris, is because they look almost pristine. They don't seem to show any sign of stress or bending or damage, which suggests that they, you know, they almost floated down, not quite floated, but certainly did not come into the Earth's atmosphere at orbital speed. So a satellite itself is traveling at about 8 kilometers per second. And that's why when they hit the atmosphere, pretty well everything burns up because they're going so fast, the friction with the atmosphere causes very high temperatures and you don't get much left. These balls on the beach have not been subjected to those temperatures. They look, as I said, they look almost pristine. And the pundits that I've spoken to suggest that what we're seeing here are what are called hydrazine fuel tanks. They're for the small thrusters that are used to control the attitude of a rocket when it's in space. They are probably still dangerous in the sense that hydrazine is a very toxic fuel, and if there's any of that stuff left inside these balls, the last thing you want to be doing is having people tinkering with it, and that's why the beach has been closed. There is a suggestion that it may have been a Chinese launch vehicle that these balls came from, but we don't really have much idea of when they appeared. I guess they must have appeared within the last few days, or else people would have noticed them before. And there have been reports actually of re-entering rocket bodies from further south than Queensland. I heard a report this morning of what was described as a fireball, and it was almost certainly a piece of space junk burning up over Newcastle, that sort of area in New South Wales.
Is there any chance of the materials, if there is any liquid in there, leaking somehow into the ocean?
That's certainly not impossible. I would suspect that these containers have valves on that may still be intact. It's very hard to tell from the images that I've seen. But yes, leakage into the ocean is a possibility. The bottom line, though, in that regard, is that the quantities are very, very small. So that would very quickly become dilute, would not be likely to cause any environmental damage, but nobody really wants this stuff lying around at all just because it is very toxic. And so I'm sure that is one of the reasons why the beach has been closed, just so people can make sure that the water quality is still okay.
Fred Watson is with us, professor at Macquarie University and astronomer. Could it have come from one of the American, there seems like a lot of rockets have been going up. We saw Artemis and could it be something from there, or is that ruled out?
I don't think it's ruled out, and you're kind of hitting the nail on the head there, Kirsten, because by far the greatest number of launches in recent years has come from the SpaceX with their Starlink project. In fact, only a week ago, SpaceX passed the record number of launches because they exceeded the total number that came through history before SpaceX. It's something like 15,000, a number that is quite staggering. So with all that stuff going up, that stuff comes down as well. And the Starlink satellites, they tend to burn up after about 5 years in orbit. But it's not likely that these space balls came from a satellite just because of the fact that they are in such good condition. I think it's more likely to have been an upper stage rocket, the thing that actually pushes the satellites into orbit and then comes back down to Earth.
In reading about this story, I discovered a job that I never knew about, a space archaeologist. And that's who is being sent in to try and understand where these space balls have come from.
Indeed, that's Alice Gorman, who's a very well-known space archaeologist. She's a very interesting character with a take on spaceflight that is exactly as her job title describes, archaeological. So she's interested in preserving some of the artifacts that we've put into space, preserving the Apollo landing sites on the moon as being future national parks or something of that sort. Really very interesting stuff. She's also done work on the International Space Station, on the archaeology of the interior of that marvellous orbiting laboratory that we see going through our skies from time to time.
I suppose hundreds of years from now, people will be looking back as this being the infancy of space exploration.
Yes, very much so. And actually, some of the artifacts that were launched in the early history of spaceflight will still be up there in hundreds of years' time. They'll still be orbiting. So the archaeologists should have a field day with those.
It's a bit of a concern. How or when are we likely to find out what these objects are?
I think once they've been collected and they will be sent to a laboratory, I'm not quite sure which one it will go to. It will either be, you know, the local emergency services laboratories, or perhaps more likely to a university, so that we can find out what they're made of. It's probably titanium, a very resilient metal, and whether there are any traces of poisonous poisonous liquid inside. So I am sure that if we keep an eye on the media, we'll hear about those things in due course. I'd love to go up there myself and have a look, but that's not practical from here in Canberra, where I am at the moment.
Oh, look, any excuse to get that warm weather, surely.
Yeah, that's right, absolutely.
Professor Fred Watson, thank you so much.
Great pleasure, Kirsten. Lovely to talk to you. Thanks.
You too. Professor Fred Watson, leading Australian astronomer. He's at Macquarie University, based in Canberra, not where these things are turning up on the beaches of North Queensland. A few of your text messages talking about football pitches. Years ago, council put soil over the concrete cricket pitches. Then a decade ago, a rubber matting was put on the concrete pitches and council stopped the soil covering. Why? Cost and making an effort to put the soil down, then remove the soil, says James in Brighton. And another text says, if injuries keep happening in any workplace, the workplace needs to change. Why is AFL exempt from workplace? You're listening to The Conversation Hour. My name's Kirsten Diprose. I am filling in for Mary Guerin.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Kirsten Diprose.
A little bit later on, we'll be going to the Ballet Australia Open House Melbourne. It's all happening at the end of this month. But before that, famous marriage celebrants. You know, we've all been inspired by, well, maybe not all of us, but some of us have been inspired by Taylor Swift's wedding and the high-profile Adam Sandler celebrant that was there. We've got on the line Bruce in Parkdale. Hi, Bruce. Oh, no, we don't. We've got some audio of Bruce, who was on ABC Breakfast this morning.
It was our wedding. It was 12 years ago. And we wanted to find someone unique, and the MC suggested Greg Evans. We didn't know he was a celebrant, so perfect match. And when the guests turned out for the wedding, they were starstruck. They were so, oh, perfect match. They were more interested in him than in us, really.
That was Ruth, just a correction there, talking to Justin. Greg Evans. I suppose that could be the problem, is if they're more interested in your celebrant than you. Well, Jane Clifton is a well-loved Australian actor, singer, painter, author, and marriage celebrant. Jane, welcome to the Conversation Hour.
Hello, Kirsten. Lovely to speak with you.
What is it about the art of being a celebrant? What attracted you to the role?
Well, I have to say that it uses all the kind of skills that I have, but people actually need them. So, you know, being able to create a ceremony for people, write something for them, being reasonably good as a public speaker. I'm basically a sucker for a marriage. I love to see people saying I do and I love you in front of all their family and friends. Great.
Agreed. I love weddings. And I want to know, 1300 222 774, what was the last wedding you went to? Was it a big flashy wedding or something a little bit low key? Jane, what are weddings like these days? Are you finding it trends? Like, are they flashy or have they gotten a bit more low key over the time you've been a celebrant?
There is huge variety of different weddings. There are so many celebrants. Now, when I started out being a celebrant in 2009, there were, I think, probably 2,000 or 3,000 celebrants in Australia, and now there's 10,000. So people are, you know, using Instagram and TikTok and all these to find a celebrant. And some people want a kind of groovy whiz-bang one, and others want a quiet sophisticated, lovely ceremony. During COVID, it was really interesting because we were stripped down to just the couple and the two witnesses and me, five people. They were the only people. And they were beautiful ceremonies because they went to the very essence of what you were doing, which was, you know, making this commitment, saying I love you in front of everybody. And I really enjoyed those immensely.
Do you ever find that guests want to meet you and want a photo with you as well as a bit of a celebrity celebrant like Ruth was talking about before? Of 'cause you don't want to take away the attention from the couple. And let's face it, particularly the bride.
I absolutely don't, and there's no danger of that because I'm not a very pretty person. The thing about the people that I marry is that they don't know me from a bar of soap. However, their parents might, or maybe their grandparents might. But it's really, the couple don't know. It's a, what, prisoner was 50 years ago. They're not going to know anything about that. But people do sometimes ask me, what's more embarrassing is in my celebrant role at a funeral when people are asking to have a photo with you and you go, come on, a bit of decorum. But the thing about me being a celebrant is that I'm already in show business, so I don't need to be the center of attention. And I work very hard to make the couple the center of attention and not me. I duck out of photos. I'll let the photographer know. I'll be out of your shot when they're having a kiss. I'm really at pains to make myself small.
1300 222 774. We'd love to hear from you as well if you are a celebrant and how you got into it. 0437 774 774. Jane Clifton is with us, who is an actor. Jane, you mentioned Prisoner. You were on the Dr. Blake mysteries, Neighbours, lots of a whole host of Aussie TV that you've been a part of. I had a little giggle to myself though when you said Prisoner at a wedding, of people knowing you from that, because that association and being a celebrant's probably not the most sensical one.
No, I mean, you know, it's just, as I say, it's such a long time ago. There's very few people who remember that. And mainly I've been an actor in theatre over the last 20, 30 years. You know, so that's why it's the parents or the grandparents that know about those sorts of things. But, you know, I don't know whether, I think in my LGBTQI community, when I'm doing same-sex marriages, that's sometimes a really big factor. They're very excited because Prisoner has a great following in that particular group of people, and it often gets mentioned in those situations, but generally it's not part of it, you know. And in terms of Adam Sandler doing Swifties, wedding on the weekend, they have a really different system in America. They don't have the same rigorous selection that we do. We have to study and do a course. We have to be approved by the Attorney General's office. It's not something you just pick up and do on the weekend. But in America, what they do is all those Elvis drive-through ones, you can get a kind of license to be a council worker or something for a day. It's like a little day certificate, and that means that you can officiate a wedding. So someone who is a celebrity like Adam, wanting to do it for a friend, that would be the process he would have gone through. I kind of can't imagine him being a working celebrant for most of his life. I don't think he needs that work.
I can't imagine how much he'd charge as well. It'd be all right if you're Taylor Swift.
He'd be doing it for free for those two, definitely.
Oh, it made me think of the Friends episode where Joey, who of course is an actor, as his character is an actor, he marries, you know, a couple of the friends on that show. Is this like a kind of a natural step for actors to go into marriage celebrants?
Well, as I say, we've got all the skills that are required in terms of, you know, presenting something and, you know, knowing about how to put on a show and helping people to put their own show on. I'm really good on the advice for that. And it is something that, you know, late career you go, well, there's something I'd like to do. But also you've got to be attracted to that work. Someone like Greg Evans, who you mentioned earlier on Perfect Match, that is a brilliant combination of, his previous stardom on Perfect Match, and apparently he takes Dexter to some of the weddings, you know, and that works really well. But it's A, about, you know, being able to present, and B, about keeping yourself out of the spotlight.
And this text message, never mind Greg Evans from Perfect Match, it's his offsider Dexter the robot that's the exactly. celebrant of the future if you listen to the AI tech bros. But about that, I don't think, you know, the marriage celebrant is something you can replace easily. We're all told that our jobs are going, but you want a person there. It's about love and relationships and people.
Absolutely. And, you know, you're not only dealing with the couple, you're dealing with their family and their friends and, you know, the people who are going to be the bridesmaids or the wing people and the groomsmen and all that. It's a big thing. So you've got to have people skills and getting on with people and being able to manage situations that might arise, of a little bit of drunkenness or bad behaviour or pushiness, or, you know, it's a management situation, and often you're outside. It might be raining. You might be on a beach and being, you know, blown away by a large wind. It's, you know, it's got everything going for it.
I've never understood beach weddings. I just think that's high risk. I did get married near a beach, so I had the beautiful backdrop, but I wasn't on one. I was very smart about that.
Sensible person. I don't get it either. They just never work, you know. It's a great idea if you're in Queensland where the weather's kind of steady. In Melbourne, stupid idea.
You're going to get blown away. Jane Clifton is with us. And talking about being a marriage celebrant, a text message says, my mother died a few years ago after my sister's wedding. We had the same celebrant at her funeral, then my dad's funeral, and then my wedding, says Susan in Mount Wallace. Isn't that lovely?
The bulk of my work these days, and it's probably to do with, you know, my age, is that I am doing a lot more funerals than I do weddings these days, and I absolutely love that work. I find that really rewarding, and quite often you will know the family, that situation, because the celebrant, you're looking after all the different rituals, weddings, funerals, naming days, and if there is a family connection in a funeral situation, it is really helpful, you know, because it's a difficult time for everybody. And if they know the person that's going to be looking after them, it's a really great thing. In terms of repeat work, I have married, you know, a young couple, and then one of their mothers decided to have a second wedding, and I did their wedding as well. So that was kind of great, you know, to have the two generations.
Yes, because on the whole, you really don't want that repeat work. It's not a good sign.
People always say to me, oh, we're not really good at this. I don't know what to do. I said, this is something you don't want to get good at. You're going to only do this once in your life if you're lucky. Leave it to me.
Jane Clifton, thank you so much. What a delight it's been to chat to you.
Oh, thank you, Kirsten, and you too.
Jane Clifton, actor, singer, painter, and, of course, marriage celebrant. Text message, Drew from Seymour says, Jane Clifton, Girl on the Wall, still one of my favourite songs. Yeah, look, is there anything Jane can't do? You are listening to The Conversation Hour. My name's Kirsten Diprose. 1300 222 774 is our number. You can text on 0437 774 774. Let's go to Jordan in Melton. Hi, Jordan.
How are you?
Yeah, good. What did you want to say?
So I've actually just recently finished a course in celebrancy in Geelong with a really wonderful group of people. And I really got to say, it has just been such a life-changing experience to delve into the world, and I've just sent a text in saying I can't wait to dig my teeth really into it now.
Why do you think it's life-changing? That's a big call.
Oh, goodness. My outlook on marriage, life, death has just completely changed. Realistically, I'm much more comfortable now with funerals, and it's really kind of opened my eyes into just communicating with people. I also put in, you know, I've been an actor for about 10 years. So I've just been sitting, nodding along with your guest every time she says something, because it really does complement really well.
And so you are doing funerals as well?
Yes, I probably will be.
I mean, that's, you know, it's the same side of the coin, isn't it? Like, it's a very different time of life, but it's supporting someone through a very significant time in their life that they'll always remember, and you're playing a role in that.
Yeah, absolutely. And really, it's about finding the way to help celebrate the life of those people, and also just going through the stories of the family, which even just through practice with my own family, I found out so much about my grandmother that I never knew.
Mm. Well, there you go, Jordan. I'm glad you are enjoying this new career move.
Yes, thank you very much. And I've just got to say, absolutely adore the ABC. You've been a part of my life for so long, so I'm really happy to be the first time caller and time listener today.
Oh, well, doubly welcome, as John Fain used to say. Thank you so much, Jordan.
Thank you so much. Have a good day.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Kirsten Diprose.
Let's head to the ballet now. There is an open house that is starting later this month as part of Open House Melbourne, where you can get a glimpse behind the scenes of the Australian Ballet. Claire Spencer is the Executive Director of the Australian Ballet. Hi, Claire.
How are you?
I'm well, thanks. What exactly will people be able to see?
Well, we're super excited because people often come and see the beauty of ballet when they come to see it in a theatre. But what they're going to see in Open House is a very hard-working company that's nestled right here in the heart of the Melbourne Arts Precinct. And we're going to open the doors and show a little bit of the grit and hard work that sits behind the beauty that you see on stage.
Are we talking costumes, sets? What kind of things are people going to see?
Well, I'll start with the wardrobe. So this is where all of our costumes are made. So we don't buy any of our costumes in. They're all made here in Melbourne. So level 4 is where our costume department is, our wardrobe department. So we'll let you in and you can see the fabrics, every kind of bead and pearl and crystal that you could possibly imagine going onto a costume. And then the working spaces where the costumes are actually bought together, where the fabrics are dyed, where the shoes are painted. It's really like a proper production centre for all of our costumes. So we'll start there and then bringing people into the areas where the dancers stay well. So being a dancer with the Australian Ballet, you really have to be at the peak of fitness. And so we commit a lot of our space to keeping our dancers fit and healthy. So we've got their gym, we've got their Pilates studio where they do all their rehabilitation. We've got an ice bath here, a full-size ice bath. I don't think we'll be allowing people to go in it on the day, but you can certainly have a look at it. And then also all the beautiful studios where the dancers rehearse, where they do warm-up class every day. So it really is the engine room of the Australian Ballet where all the magic happens.
That's absolutely fascinating, Claire. I had no idea that the wardrobes would be sort of done on site and the shoes and the like. I thought that would just be done somewhere else.
No, it's part of the depth of the Australian Ballet, and one of the reasons why our productions are so admired. Of course, it's for the dancing and the musicality from the orchestra, but it's the craft that sits behind every production. So the painting of the sets and the making of the costumes, it really is like a deep level of craft. And we have many, many artisans on our team here at the Australian Ballet that bring those things to life.
Claire Spencer is with us, Executive Director of the Australian Ballet. There is an open house that is on Friday the 24th of July and Saturday the 25th of July where you can get a glimpse of what goes on. Are there particular shows on that you'll see the costumes for?
Yeah, so there's quite a bit going on at the moment. We've just closed Romeo and Juliet and Copeland dance episodes here in Melbourne. So the costumes for those will be cleaned and repaired before they go back to our store out in Altona. We also have a national tour that's about to kick off. So that's going to Narre Warren, to Albury, to Ballarat, to Horsham and Mildura. So the costumes for that will be in and out. And then we're also preparing for a tour to the United States at the end of September. And then we're straight back from the US into the reopening of the Ian Potter State Theatre at Arts Centre Melbourne, where we're opening a season of The Nutcracker on the 28th of October. So there is a hive of activity going on, and the costume department will be very full, but it's glorious when you see everything all together and you realise kind of that depth of the depth of quality that go into our productions and the hard work that sits behind every one of them.
Yeah, there's a lot going on. And I know that the Stuttgart Ballet is also bringing the Sleeping Beauty exclusively to Melbourne in October as well. That's really
right.
Exciting.
Oh my goodness, I can't believe I forgot to mention Stuttgart Ballet. This shows how much we've got going on. Yes, we're so excited. We've been talking to them, gosh, probably for 2 or 3 years about this production now. So really delighted that that's going to be coming to the Regent Theatre for Melbourne audiences. So they will fill our slots in the Regent while we're in the US. But please go and see it. Amazing company with a really beautiful production of The Sleeping Beauty.
Has Ballet Australia done this open house previously?
Do you know, I don't think we have. I've only been with the ballet for 15, 16 months now. And when the opportunity came up, it was actually one of my team suggested that we do it. And I'm not sure we have done it before, but it just felt like such a natural thing for us to do. There's a very, very big ballet community here in Melbourne, both people who practice the art of ballet in their local ballet school, as well as a very loyal audience here in Melbourne. So we just thought, well, let's do it. Let's open up. So we did the launch of Open House here actually a couple of weeks ago. And it was just fantastic to open up the front door and say, come on in, come and see what we do.
Claire, I've got quite a few text messages coming in saying that the open days are sold out. So the Ballet Open House is sold out immediately.
Fantastic.
Lots of questions saying, will they open again, please? Says ballet fan.
Well, look, my goodness, if the demand's there, we'll certainly look at it. We love the, I love that we've sold out already. There's nothing that makes an executive director happier than a sold out show.
Absolutely. But looks like you've got a lot more fans out there that want to get in. So hopefully something can happen.
Yeah, we'll certainly have a look at that.
Claire Spencer, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Claire Spencer there, Executive Director of the Australian Ballet. Yes, those dates are the 24th and 25th of July, but with multiple tours, but it looks like from our people on the text line that it's already sold out. Hopefully they can sort something out and get some more tours because it is very popular. Katie says, I went on a tour of the Ballet Centre some years ago with my ballet dancing daughter. It was fantastic. My daughter audibly gasp when she walked into a room full of point shoes. Oh, the costume department was incredible, says Katie. 1300 222 774. Our text line is 0437 774 774. We've also been asking to speak to wedding celebrants, marriage celebrants, about their job, and we've got Geraldine on the line. Hi, Geraldine.
Hello, how are you?
You texted in to tell us that Jane Clifton was your celebrant.
She was in 2016, and second marriage for both of us. My husband and I got married at the Fairfield Boathouse, and she was absolutely wonderful, funny, witty, as you can imagine, but very sensitive as well, because I'd had breast cancer the year before, and she was just wonderful the way she rolled that into our story, etc. So yeah, I could highly recommend her. She's magic.
And it's so nice to have good memories of the celebrant, isn't it? Like, it's obviously day, but you want to make sure someone's good that's there.
Well, she was wonderful from the beginning. You know, we'd go and meet her in her office and sort of sort through the life story and vows, etc., etc. And she was just brilliant, absolutely brilliant.
Oh, that's good. And you're still married to this day?
We are very happily married. Thank God.
That's, better. That's good to hear, Geraldine. That's good to hear. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you. Bye now.
1300 222 774. Aggie is in Wantirna. Hi, Aggie. You're a celebrant.
I am. Yes, I am.
And how long have you been doing that?
Oh, since 2008.
Ah, and what made you go into the career?
Well, I used to be a high school teacher of English music and drama, and I used to also organise all the Deb balls. And when I decided to retire, I went to see the careers counsellor, and I said, I'm thinking of becoming a celebrant, because if I can do a Deb ball, I can marry people. Yes, because there were thousands, you know, like hundreds of kids doing Debs. Some of them were trying. And so he said, yeah, and he pointed me to a TAFE course, and I did that when I finished teaching. And so that was in 2008, and I've been a celebrant ever since.
What do you love about it?
I love meeting people. I love hearing their amazing stories. I love supporting them through the whole process. Some don't like to be centres of attention. They don't like everyone staring at them. So, you know, it's a delicate balance, because they are the centre of attention. And funerals as well, it's really important that you can make people feel comfortable, listen to, make sure they understand that whatever they want to do is okay. And guide them through the whole process, so that when the day comes, they know exactly what's going to happen and they're ready.
Aggie, thank you so much for telling us about your wonderful role as a celebrant. Wendy from Oyen texted in to say, my husband and I were married 47 years ago by Dally Messenger, who was one of the very first Victorian celebrants. Well, there you go. It's bye from me. Till next time, take care.